to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Sunday, January 31st, 2021. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region, and each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. And now, let's take a look at today's weather. Our AccuWeather forecast calls for periods of snow during the morning and then tapering off to a few flurries late in the day, with accumulations of 3 to 6 inches. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high of 32 with a low of 21. On Monday, a high of 30 with a low of 15. Again, breezy today with a bit of snow. And across the area, breezy again with a bit of snow and a storm totals of 3 to 6 inches. Our sunrise today was at 7:27 a.m. and will set at 5:29 p.m. The moonrise today, 8:56 p.m., and the moonset at 9:28 a.m. And now let's take a look at the headlines in the first story in today's Des Moines Register. Our first story is written by Mark Emmert and is entitled, Iowa Has Uphill Battle in Title IX. Experts say plaintiffs have a good case. From Iowa City. 4 years after losing a court case that centered on his treatment of women in his department, Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta finds himself in another high-stakes legal battle that could have national implications. And sports gender equity experts interviewed by the Des Moines Register believe the plaintiffs have a good case, which could force Barta to reverse course on his plan to drop the women's swimming and diving team and potentially add another sport for female athletes. Four members of the Hawkeye women's swimming and diving team are suing the university over Barta's decision to cut the sport after this season, a move they contend violates the federal law known as Title IX, which requires schools to provide equal opportunities for male and female athletes. Their argument is that Iowa, along with most major university athletic departments, is well out of balance when it comes to roster spots devoted to women. They are not only trying to preserve their sport, but are asking U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose to require Iowa to add another sport for female athletes, a sign of how strongly they believe in their case. Here's another sign. The plaintiffs have posted a $360,000 bond required by Rose. That money will be lost if Iowa prevails here. Given the history at Iowa, where there has been such a pattern of discrimination against women staffers and ongoing complaints about gender inequalities there, I think it probably was not the wisest move to have cut a woman's sport, said Ellen Starowski, a professor of sport management at Ithaca College, who has written about the case for Sports Litigation Alert. But the university is not backing down. It filed a request for the case to be dismissed outright, even after Rose issued an injunction forcing Iowa to maintain its women's swimming program until the matter is resolved. On January 22nd, the university asked the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn Rose's injunction, an indication that this will be a lengthy and contentious legal proceeding. Barta argued that he needed to cut four sports. Three are men's teams, gymnastics, swimming and diving, and tennis. To save $5 million a year to offset an anticipated $60 million gap in this year's budget, because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The budget for women's swimming and diving is $1.5 million annually. But getting rid of a women's sports team brings scrutiny of a university's standing in relation to Title IX and is often accompanied by legal action. Michigan State Athletic Director Bill Beekman made a similar discovery after his October announcement that he was cutting his men's and women's swimming programs after this season. On January 15th, 11 members of the women's swim team filed a Title IX lawsuit that parallels the Iowa case. Barta and Beekman were the only two of the 14 Big Ten Conference athletic directors to attempt to terminate a women's sport during the pandemic. For Barta, age 57, the loss of a second court case related to gender equity could come at a vulnerable time professionally. The university is seeking a replacement for retiring president Bruce Harreld, who has publicly supported Barta, even after a $6.5 million gender discrimination settlement was paid to two of his former female employees in 2017. The Iowa lawsuit is being watched carefully by national experts of Title IX law, and the general assessment of those interviewed by the Register is that the university is fighting a losing battle once again, one it never needed to risk. With court proceedings being delayed during the pandemic, even the lawyers involved have no idea when Rose will decide whether to let this case proceed to trial. But if she does, Iowa will bear the burden of proof. Jim LaRue is the attorney representing Hawkeye swimmers Kelsey Drake, Christina Kaufman, Sage Olensullen, and Alexa Puccini. His strategy is simple: make the university show its math. Title IX requires schools that receive federal funding to provide athletic opportunities for women at the same rate as their representation in the undergraduate student body. The percentage of women enrolled at Iowa has been slowly increasing and is at 55% this school year. The university gets 2 percentage points of leeway in this calculation, meaning that's at least 424 of the roughly 800 student athletes projected for the 2021 season, which would need to be women. At 53%. This should be a simple thing to prove, but LaRue said the university has declined to turn over its list of athletes. Rose, in her December 24th ruling in favor of an injunction, was also frustrated by Iowa's reluctance to produce the rosters for its 24 sports for the 2019-2020 season. At the conclusion of the first day of hearing this matter, the court inquired whether Iowa's official Title IX athlete counts would be turned over for court review. Rose wrote. Defendants have not been responsive to either request. LaRue is convinced the university is padding the number of women getting genuine roster spots, particularly among the rowing and track and field teams. Securing an injunction in the case appeared to move LaRue one step closer to a full trial, and that is when he would get a closer look at Iowa's roster management through the discovery process. The university's appeal, however, may pause proceedings. LaRue intends to examine which athletes regularly attended practices and traveled for competitions, signs that they were legitimate members of the team. He questions whether all of the 94 participants on the rowing team and each of the 130 in the women's track and field area are getting equal athletic opportunities in terms of access to coaching and any hope of actually participating in a varsity event. Barbara Osborne, a professor of sports management at North Carolina who also holds a law degree, believes she knows exactly what LaRue will find if the case goes to trial. Proportionately, it's just simple math. It's not surprising at all that the court issued an injunction because you just have to do math, and it shows they're not in compliance, said Osborne, who has been following the case at Iowa. Osborne pointed to a 2013 court decision that prevented Quinnipiac University in Connecticut from dropping its women's volleyball team and replacing it with competitive cheerleading. The judge found that the university was listing women on the rosters of the cross-country and indoor and outdoor track teams, even though many of them truly competed in only one of those disciplines. If you're padding your women's roster so that the total number that you've padded would easily allow you to add a women's team, the court expects you to add a women's team, Osborne said. Quinnipiac restored volleyball, and added women's golf and rugby teams. LaRue is also asking the judge to compel Iowa to add a women's sport, in addition to keeping swimming. Wrestling and rugby are the two emerging sports identified in the lawsuit, although Ross wouldn't have the leeway to specify which sport gets added, if that is her determination. Iowa's athletic department would make that call. Iowa wrestling coach Tom Brands has been vocal about his desire to field a women's team alongside his top-ranked men's team. The sport has a deep history in the state, and last weekend's state high school girls wrestling tournament included 457 participants. Girls-only wrestling remains, however, an unsanctioned sport in Iowa. Starowski believes that, by asking the court to add a women's sports team as well as retain swimming, Rue is showing the strength of his position. When Barta announced August 21st that he was cutting four sports after this season, he said Title IX compliance was one of the factors he used to guide that decision. The university contends that he has met all requirements of Title IX after a two-year investigation by the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, arising out of a 2015 complaint lodged by field hockey players. As proof, Iowa pointed to an October 2019 closure letter from the office that said as much. The office found disparities in the way male and female athletes were treated, but no violations of its regulations. Iowa was given time to address those. That letter noted that Iowa provided information to the Office for Civil Rights showing that, in 2016-2017, 52.6% of undergraduate students were women, as were 52.2% of its participants in athletics. But how the university arrived at those numbers wasn't included in any public record. The university, which is being represented by the Iowa Attorney General's Office, declined to make any of its athletic department officials available for an interview with the Register while the court case is pending. In a statement, though, the university said of the judge's injunction, quote, "While the university disagrees with some of the court findings, the university will allow the court's order and will maintain the program and provide staffing and benefits until the matter is resolved. Our commitment to gender equity and our student athletes remains strong. We are proud of our women swimmers." End quote. The university's defense is laid out in affidavits from Barbara Burke, Iowa's associate athletic director and senior women's administrator, and Lila Clary, its associate athletic director for compliance. Burke took exception to claims that the university is inflating the number of female athletes, writing in her affidavit, "Rosters are completed and verified by the athletics compliance office at the end of each competitive season. Our coaches have integrity, and I and other UI athletic administrators are dedicated to ensuring student athlete health, safety, and welfare. Such malfeasance could not occur as alleged." Clary said her office carefully tracks the weekly participation of each athlete while in season and confirms that information with each student. She said the university keeps its official squad list private because they contain protected student education records. That means the university is citing one federal law, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, as a reason it cannot demonstrate compliance with another, being Title IX. Rue wondered why the school couldn't simply redact any private educational records, which are not at issue, and provide the information the court is seeking. The rosters that Iowa lists on its athletics website show 64 women on its track and field team, including 23 that are also listed under the cross-country team. The university is projecting that there will be 131 total competitors on those teams next season, as opposed to 109 on its men's squads. Similarly, there are only 57 women shown on the online rowing roster, with the team size projected at 92 for 2021-22, although that sport is not yet in season and is currently recruiting new members. Iowa's attorneys got a victory when Rose required the plaintiffs to produce the $360,000 bond, which we set aside to defray costs the university may incur as it keeps the women's swimming team afloat, should the university ultimately prevail in the lawsuit. The school estimated that it would actually cost $1.1 million to compete in women's swimming in 2021-2022, if the matter isn't resolved by then. Osborne said such bond stipulations are somewhat common in class action lawsuits like this one. It's basically, put your money where your mouth is, because they don't want the people who brought the class action to just drop out when they're out of eligibility to compete in college sports, she said. If you're going to litigate this, then we want to know you're in for the long haul. LaRue declined to say who put up the money on behalf of his clients, but he appealed that part of Rose's ruling to the Eighth Circuit Court shortly after Iowa filed its appeal to the injunction. That's one more matter that will need to be settled. Title IX became law in 1972, at a time when college football had a large following, but wasn't the massive income driver it has become. There were only 11 bowl games played that year, a number that has more than tripled since. There were no billion-dollar cable TV contracts or multi-million-dollar coaching staffs operating in ornate training facilities. Christine Grant, who was women's athletic director at Iowa from 1973 until 2000, testified before Congress to help get Title IX passed in 1972. She is a pioneer in gender equity efforts. The fact that the university is now being sued for allegedly violating that law was mentioned with dismay by both Starowski and Osborne. LaRue, too, plans to seize on that juxtaposition to challenge Iowa to gain its status as a leader of providing opportunities for women athletes. To balance football roster sizes, that's well to more than 100. Iowa is projecting next year's team to include 129 players. Schools began adding women's sports. Iowa made an early commitment to field hockey, the sport Grant once coached. In 2003, it began the women's rowing team, the most recent sport added. Rowing is frequently a sport that is viewed skeptically by Title IX experts, since schools often report roster sizes that can also reach into the hundreds. Washington, for example, was forced to explain in 2017 how it could list 145 women on its rowing team after a Seattle Times investigation found at least 8 who claimed they had no idea they were considered to be members of the team. Iowa rowing coach Andrew Carter, in an affidavit filed December 18th, was adamant that all of his rowers get the same level of training, equipment, and opportunities to compete. His team consists of experienced rowers, but also dozens of Iowa students who excelled in other sports in high school, but were recruited to try rowing once they got to campus, a process he calls talent transfer. They competed in novice events, but he said they also can be elevated to varsity competition as their skill improves. On Tuesday, the Twitter account of the Iowa rowing team sent out a notice for upcoming tryouts, seeking women who are 5'8" or taller, missing competitive sports, looking to try something new, and wanting to compete for a Big Ten championship. Carter said that's a standard way to find new members of his team. He bristled at LaRue's depiction of junior varsity level element to his program. They are integral to all we do, and therefore the resources brought to bear toward their success, both on and off the water, reflect that, Carter wrote in his affidavit. Work in explaining the need for a roster of 90-plus rowers pointed out that to field a team at the Big Ten Championships, 51 athletes are needed in 7 different events. Still, LaRue plans to let rows decide whether rowing's novice competitions are in line with the spirit of Title IX, since there is no such designation in any male sport offered at Iowa. Starowski said that any school accused of manipulating its rosters faces the burden of proving to a judge that the athletes listed were genuine participants in the sport. She said, after 50 years in existence, federal judges are not giving universities any benefit of the doubt when it comes to Title IX compliance. Those old arguments that the schools need more time are not holding up as well because schools have had much more opportunity to get into compliance and are basically showing that they have not had the will to do it, Starowski said. I think that schools are being called out on this. Starowski pointed to recent episodes at Brown University in Rhode Island and William and Mary in Virginia, both of which backed off plans to cut women's sports teams after litigation was threatened. It's rare that such cases are brought to trial. The risk is high because of what information universities may be forced to reveal, and because the ultimate penalty for remaining in violation of Title IX is loss of federal funding. For Iowa, that would be in excess of $500 million. Instead, schools either settle the matter, or, if found to be out of compliance with Title IX, quickly enter into a consent agreement with the Office for Civil Rights to remedy this situation. Osborne is surprised that Iowa hasn't already agreed to restore the women's swimming and diving team and avoid a potentially embarrassing lawsuit. At trial, LaRue will undoubtedly point out every way that women athletes are treated differently at Iowa than the men, including the amount of money spent on coaching salaries, the publicity they receive, the quality of the facilities, travel expenses, and more. Iowa paid football coach Kirk Ferentz $5.6 million in fiscal year 2020. Basketball coach Lisa Bluter, the highest salaried leader of a Hawkeye women's team, made $1.1 million. If it goes to trial, past precedent is definitely on the side of female athletes, Osborne said. The law is so clear of what is required. Iowa's track record is really, really bad for losing their cases, so I don't understand why they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on litigation when they could easily put that money into women's programs and they would be fine. It doesn't make sense, except when you have stubborn leaders that think they can do whatever they want to do and not have consequences for it. They certainly aren't making the kinds of decisions that you should see most athletic administrators and college presidents make across the country. Nancy Hogshead Mocker was born in Iowa City, grew up in Florida, and won 3 gold medals in swimming at the 1984 Olympics. She is now a lawyer and CEO of Champion Women, which advocates for gender equity in sports. Hogshead Mocker compiled data that showed most Big Ten schools were out of compliance with Title IX, mailing it in June to each institution and the league office. BARDA was among those who received the information, which has been well circulated among those with an interest in the topic. In light of that, Starowski was perplexed to see Iowa and Michigan State announce plans to cut a women's sports team. Minnesota, for example, opted to eliminate 3 men's sports as a cost-saving measure related to the pandemic. I find it interesting that a watchdog group had notified these schools that they were already in a concerning position related to Title IX, and schools went forward anyway, Starowski said. BARDA, who said the decision to cut sports pained him, now must prove that he made it within the parameters of federal law with regard to gender equity. This will be complicated by his 2017 settlement with his former top assistant, Jane Meyer, and ex-field hockey coach Tracy Grisbaum. BARDA dismissed them both, claiming poor job performance, but offered no documentation of that as their cases proceeded. The women who are partners said they lost their jobs because of their gender and sexual orientation. A Polk County jury, hearing Meyer's case, agreed, finding the university at fault on all 5 counts and awarding her $1.4 million. Iowa then settled that case and avoided a trial with Grisbaum, paying $6.5 million to the former employees and their lawyers while admitting no guilt. Osborne said such a verdict can be seen by a judge as evidence that BARDA is overseeing a toxic culture in his department for women who work for him and the athletes under his care. LaRue said he will raise that issue and also point to comments BARDA made to reporters shortly after the trial, in which he claimed he was very confident in the decisions that he made regarding Meyer and Grisbaum. Was that an indication that BARDA doesn't understand or doesn't care about what he did wrong? LaRue believes it is a question that Rose needs to consider. Starowski was even more pointed, noting that the Meyer-Grisbaum case is recent history, one that seems to be repeating. If you add up the amount of legal expenses that have been associated with the athletic department's failure to comply with gender equity laws, they've well outspent any of the savings that they would have made from cutting the women's swim team, Starowski said. I just wonder how an athletic director gets to keep their job with this kind of persistent problem. Turning the page, Public Terrace spent $300,000 for January 6th Trump D.C. rally. Grocery chain Publix Supermarkets responded to online blowback after the Wall Street Journal reported the company's Harris donated $300,000 to fund the January 6th rally before the riot at the U.S. Capitol. Julie Jenkins Fancelli, daughter of Publix founder George Jenkins, donated more than $980,000 to President Trump's 2020 campaign and the Republican Party, the Journal reported Saturday. She also provided the majority of the funds for the $500,000 rally near the White House. Publix posted a statement on Twitter saying, Mrs. Fancelli is not an employee of Publix Supermarkets and is neither involved in our business operations, nor does she represent the company in any way. We cannot comment on Mrs. Fancelli's actions. But many on Twitter have criticized the statement as hollow, and the hashtags hashtag Publix and hashtag boycott Publix were trending Saturday. Also involved with funding the event, according to the Journal, pundit and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, who founded the far-right InfoWars media outlet. He provided $50,000 for the pro-Trump rally held at the Eclipse, the Journal reported. Jones posted a video on January 9th, saying he helped arrange funding for the event, the Austin American-Statesman previously reported. Jones, the Proud Boys, promoters of QAnon conspiracy theory, and others used Parler to post flyers for the Save America rally and urge supporters to attend. Vancelli picked Carolyn Wren, a Trump fundraiser, to help coordinate the event with Ali Alexander, the leader of the Stop the Steal movement, the Journal reported. During the rally, Trump told the crowd, "We're going to walk down to the Capitol and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women." From the Associated Press in Washington, GameStop traders fueled by spite. But taking on Wall Street comes with financial risk. They've endured a financial crisis, two deep recessions, mounds of student debt, stagnant pay, costly health care, dim job prospects. They've seen the uber-rich grow richer, while a pandemic threw tens of millions of people out of work and left many more isolated and vulnerable at home. Now, they feel, it's payback time. Nearly a decade after the Occupy protest movement left Wall Street more or less unscathed, the citadel of financial power faces a new assault. Day traders, mobilized on a Reddit chat room, have poured about all the money they can find into the stocks of a struggling video game retailer called GameStop and a few other beaten-down companies. Their buying swelled those companies' share prices beyond anyone's imagination and, not coincidentally, inflicted huge losses on the hedge funds of the super-rich, who had placed bets that the stocks would drop. Their strategy is freighted with risk. The prices of the stocks they've bought are now multiples above any level justified by revenue, earnings, or future prospects. The danger is that at any time, the stocks could collapse. But as one Reddit user wrote Friday, asserting that hedge fund financiers would drink champagne as they looked down upon Occupy Wall Street protesters in 2011, "I'd rather lose it all than give them what they need to destroy me. I'll burn it all down just to spite them." Their rage and hell-bent drive to pick on powerful Wall Street financiers sent shivers through ordinary investors and heightened fears about the fragility of the markets in general after a prolonged period of stock gains fueled by ultra-low interest rates. Those fears just caused the S&P 500 index to suffer its worst week of losses since October. GameStop shares rocketed nearly 70% on Friday. Over the past 3 weeks, they delivered a stupefying 1,600% gain. "They figured out how to play the way Wall Street has been playing for a long time," said Robert Thompson, who has long tracked cultural trends as director of Syracuse University's Wire Center for Television and Popular Culture. "I'm amazed it didn't happen earlier." Feeding the frenzy has been young traders like Zach Weir, age 27, who last week bought 5 shares of GameStop. "I'm a college student, so that's basically a month's rent for me," Weir said. "He did it," he said, "because he believes in the cause. Protecting a cherished game store, where he would hang out as a teenager on Friday nights, from financial tycoons who want the company to fail. And if he loses his investment? If my account goes to zero, it goes to zero," Weir said. "At this point, it's not about the money. I think this is bigger than the money now." Frustration and rage over widening financial inequities in the American economy have been mounting for years. The richest 1% of Americans collected about 19% of pre-tax income in 2019, up from less than 11% 4 decades earlier, according to the World Inequality Database, run by Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman, economists at the University of California, Berkeley, along with other researchers. New York University economist Edward Wolff found that the richest 10% of Americans own roughly 85% of stock wealth, a share that has grown steadily. The financial crisis that ignited the Great Recession of 2007 through 2009 intensified resentment toward the bankers who had financed the dodgy loans behind the catastrophe, and it ignored obvious risks, only to receive bailouts from taxpayers and largely escape accountability. Rising outrage fueled the Occupy movement, in which protesters took over New York's Zuccotti Park and other public spaces and demanded far-reaching financial reforms that mainly didn't happen. The coronavirus inflicted further pain, flattening the economy and causing more than 20 million Americans to lose jobs. Last week, a report from the anti-poverty group Oxfam found that the world's 10 richest men have swollen their collective wealth by $500 billion since the pandemic erupted in March. Meanwhile, nearly 10 million people who lost jobs to the pandemic remain unemployed. The stock market, the chosen target of the Reddit day traders, has long stood as America's premier symbol of entrenched wealth. But technology, including forums like Reddit, has made it even easier, faster, and simpler for the aggrieved to mobilize, swap information, and collectively plot strategy. And e-trading apps, notably Robinhood, allow amateur traders to buy commission-free stocks with one click. A vulnerability was spotted in the market, the so-called short squeeze. When hedge funds and other investors want to bet that a stock price will fall, they arrange a short sale. They borrow shares of, say, GameStop. Then they sell those borrowed shares, planning to buy back the stock later at a lower price and pocket the gain. But shorting can backfire disastrously if the stock surges instead of falling. Then the short sellers can be forced to bail out of their bets by buying the target stock. Their buying, in turn, can send the stock price even higher, and makes things even worse for the short sellers in an intensifying feedback loop. GameStop, its future imperiled by the e-commerce and a pandemic that has kept customers away, is among the most heavily shorted stocks. Some of the Reddit rebels are gamers who want to protect the retailer from the predators of Wall Street, or just deliver a righteous blow to hedge funds and financiers who have lived large as others have suffered hardships. Not all of the day traders are inflamed by anger. They just see an opportunity to make money and pay bills. "A lot of people are having trouble paying rent," said Alexis Goldstein, a veteran of the Occupy movement. Yet Goldstein worries that the revolt will fail. Some of the Wall Street firms that are targets of the Redditors actually profit from the very volatility that the Redditors' assault has whipped up, and the most sophisticated professional traders are no doubt calculating how to capitalize on the chaos. "I suspect it's not Robinhood investors and Redditors who are making money," Goldstein said. We're going to switch over now to the Metro and Iowa section, and the first article, written by Aaron Jordan and Jared Strong. "Police often hold on to footage, body camera video sometimes revealing, if the public is then allowed to see it." When an Iowa City officer in 1996 accidentally shot and killed Eric Shaw, an artist working late in his father's office, Troy Kelsey wasn't the one who fired the gun, but knew the police had made a terrible mistake when he saw blood flowing from Shaw's body. Then, the standard practice was for police departments to say, "No comment," said Kelsey, who, after 27 years in the Iowa City Police Department, is chief in University Heights, an enclave of about 1,100 people tucked within Iowa City. The police department and the city, wrongly I think, were saying no comment. Saying "we screwed up" wasn't going to change anything, but you're better off saying "I screwed up royally. What can I do to deal with the here and now? And what can I do in the future so that this doesn't happen again?" That experience made Kelsey strive to be as open as possible with the community, whether that means answering to a citizens' review board or releasing body camera video to the public. University Heights allows the public, including news reporters, to review video from police body cameras or in-car cameras under Iowa Code Chapter 22, Iowa's open records law, with permission of the chief or other authorized employees. But not every law enforcement agency across Iowa has the same policy. Some departments say police video should be released to the public only if it serves in the interest of the agency. Others make no mention of the video as a public record, although, according to Iowa law, it is. A decade after Iowa law enforcement agencies started using body cameras, Iowa has a widely divergent, unregulated system of rules and policies governing public access to a tool that many saw at the outset as a way of monitoring the conduct of police. Those disparities, found in a review of the policies of more than 200 agencies, can endanger the ability of everyday Iowans to answer questions about a family member's death at the hands of police, or prove their innocence. For instance, Autumn Steele, a mother who was accidentally shot and killed in 2015 by a Burlington police officer while standing in her yard with her child. Video footage and other records released by the order of a federal judge in a $2 million wrongful death lawsuit show what the family says was a police effort to cherry-pick information and witness statements to blunt police liability. Isaiah Hayes, a black man from Wisconsin, who was fatally shot in 2018 by a Polk County Sheriff's deputy. The office eventually agreed to release footage of the incident to the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, which sued for release of the records. but only after a 15-month legal battle that cost taxpayers $120,000. Drew Edwards, age 22, died in June of 2019 after being tased by Maquoketa police. The city didn't release the body camera video for months, even after the case was closed, citing protection of Edwards' privacy. But it was Edwards' family that wanted the video. The family eventually won a $4.5 million wrongful death settlement. Members of the Iowa Newspaper Association requested and received video policies from more than 200 law enforcement agencies for this report, which examines how police are using body cameras, how easy or hard it is to access police video, and what ideas Iowans have for balancing privacy and accountability. Iowa law enforcement agencies started using cameras decades ago to record interactions with the public, but the use has evolved as technology has changed. When Carroll County Sheriff Ken Pingree was hired to be a deputy about 20 years ago in western Iowa, his patrol vehicle had a handheld camcorder mounted to its dash. He'd spent the first 10 years of his career without cameras, and it was sometimes difficult to remember to hit the record button for traffic stops. "When I first started, you had a radio in your car, a radar unit, and a light bar controller," Pingree said. "Now there are printers, computers, cameras, all the other stuff." The Carroll County office later upgraded to new systems that included a metal storage box in the trunk that held a large tape recorder that started automatically when the red and blue lights were activated. Around that time, in Iowa City, Alton Poole started fiddling with smaller cameras and tried to affix one to his University of Iowa police uniform. He had watched the dash cam recording of a state trooper in a scuffle with someone who tried to grab the trooper's gun. The problem with the video was that the reach for the gun happened outside of the camera's view. "Made it very easy for the public to jump to conclusions," Poole recalled. "After seeing that, I thought, why aren't we equipping our person with cameras?" Poole said his department was the first in the state and one of the first in the nation to equip all of its officers with body-worn cameras, which happened in 2011. Of more than 200 agencies that responded to a request from Iowa media outlets, 90% now use body cameras. At $600 to $900 per camera, not to mention computer servers that can cost up to $500,000, cost is the limiting factor. These expensive tools have changed law enforcement, in part by deterring bad behavior on both sides of the camera, officers said. Poole likes to tell a story about asking a tailgater with an open container to empty his beer can. He asked, "What if I told you I was an attorney?" Poole recalled. "I responded, what if I told you I was recording this conversation for the judge?" Then the attorney poured out his drink. Opelousas County Sheriff Gary Anderson recently responded to a complaint against one of his officers by reviewing the body camera video and seeing that the complainant's third-hand account was mistaken. "If someone comes in here and wants to make a complaint, sit down and watch the video with me," said Anderson, who has been at the Southern Iowa Agency for 34 years, 21 as the sheriff. "I have nothing to hide." Body cameras also can help law enforcement supervisors detect and address misconduct among officers, said Sergeant Paul Parizic, public information officer for the Des Moines Police Department. In 2019, Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert fired Officer Lourdes Haydenfeld after her body camera video showed she lied about what happened during a traffic stop. Haydenfeld said a driver struck the officer's arm with her car's side mirror, but the video showed otherwise. Other examples have come up in hearings for officers seeking unemployment benefits after being fired. In 2019, Muscatine officer Benjamin Valera punched a handcuffed woman in the face, which knocked her to the ground, records show. The incident was captured on body camera video, then more widely circulated when the officer used his cell phone to make a recording of it, which he showed to other officers, emergency dispatchers, and his father. In a 2018 traffic stop, Adam Olson, a North Liberty police sergeant, failed to do a pat-down search of three people suspected of shooting out the window of a vehicle, an administrative law judge found. A fellow officer who examined the video found Olson had committed more than a dozen policy violations during the stop. Body cam video and witness cell phone video have streamlined prosecution of criminal cases in Butler County, said Greg Lovins, who recently retired after 32 years as county attorney. Video reduces the number of depositions before trial and answers questions for defense attorneys, he said. Now that body cameras are the norm, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and residents expect video of every police interaction. And they expect to be able to see everything, like they would with a TV crew filming an episode of CSI. Jurors sit there and they watch a 30-minute television show and they expect lasers. They expect three-dimensional animation. They expect to watch the crime being recreated right in front of them, said Black Hawk County Sheriff Tony Thompson, who is president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. There are cases where a prosecutor has been unwilling to prosecute the case because of a body cam fail. Poole agreed, saying, "When you have a jury trial, one of the first things they ask is, where's the video? If there's no video, it didn't happen." Most agencies have written policies for officers using body-worn cameras and in-car cameras, although a dozen sheriffs and police chiefs noted their policies were outdated. Some still mention VHS tapes, and said new versions are in the works. The word policy is used loosely by some agencies. The Ackley Police Department, a four-officer agency in Hardin County, has a two-paragraph memo from September 24, 2019, that includes the directive, "You are all professionals, so use your judgment when you use them." The policies run the gamut in amount of time to save the recordings, ranging from as little as a week to indefinitely. In Forest City, police video of a traffic stop in which there is no known arrest or other known reason to place the video into evidence may be deleted in 7 days. The Jones County Sheriff's Office policy says system files of non-evidentiary value are maintained for a minimum of 30 days and then classified as junk. But sometimes the public may not request a video of an interaction with police until later. If someone is pulled over for a traffic stop they feel is not proper, they've got a way to take a look at it, said Pete McRoberts, ACLU of Iowa Policy Director, about body camera footage. People can be honest, but still wrong, about what they recall. A body cam can break the tie. Video from body cams or in-car cameras often is useful for training and can help officers learn how to avoid acting on an implicit bias, McRoberts said. Neither the State Sheriffs and Deputies Association nor the State Police Association provides policy recommendations, and the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy does not train recruits on how to use body cameras because of the different technologies in use around the state. Nearly half the Iowa police policies reviewed identified video as a public record, either by mentioning Iowa Code Chapter 22, or stating media would be allowed to view video in at least some circumstances. But many chiefs and sheriffs have declined to release video, even in closed cases, and even when the person shown in the video wants it to be made public. There shouldn't be any issue of when they, the videos, should be released, said David O'Brien, a Cedar Rapids lawyer who represented the family of Autumn Steele, and, more recently, is using body camera video in a wrongful death lawsuit filed against the Burlington police officer who fatally shot Marquis Jones in 2017. How can you argue a body camera isn't immediate facts and circumstances? O'Brien asked, referring to language in the Chapter 22 Opens Record Law that requires law enforcement officers to release the immediate facts and circumstances of criminal cases unless they could jeopardize an investigation or put people at risk. I think they should be released immediately. The law is pretty clear on it. Anderson from Appanoose County would like to have an open conversation with law enforcement, the media, and privacy advocacy groups like the ACLU about when video is released. There needs to be some discussions made, but not demands from people, Anderson said. Do we need to re-abuse a female, a child, or whoever with a video that's going to be coming out? That has some long-term mental health ramifications. The ACLU seeks to protect the privacy of people inadvertently shown on camera or people in their homes who aren't part of a police investigation. Once someone is part of a public investigation, arrest or stop, that becomes a public record, McRoberts said. More than half of U.S. states have a law that addresses release of body camera video, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press has reported. The law in Minnesota, where George Floyd was killed last spring in the custody of a Minneapolis police department, says recordings become public if they show the discharge of a firearm or the use of force by an officer that results in substantial bodily harm. Another reason is for the person shown in the video who wants it to be public. Missouri's law, passed in 2016, allows police videos to remain secret until after a criminal case is closed, or if the video was shot in a private location. The exception to the last part is if the person shown in the recording wants the video. Gunita Singh, legal fellow with the Reporters Committee, said states don't necessarily need a law on body cameras, but policymakers need to make sure laws reflect changing technology. As technology continues to evolve, we need to broaden the scope of what constitutes a public record, to which the public and the press are entitled, she said. In Iowa, especially, the law has a presumption of disclosure. Laws governing body-worn cameras must strive to facilitate openness. Cedar Rapids lawyer Sam Jones wants law enforcement agencies to adapt their policies in recognition of mounting court verdicts that require release of body camera video. It's a bit of a bruising process, but ultimately this litigation is healthy, he said. There will be greater certainty as a result of it. In 2019, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled a lower court was correct to balance confidentiality and transparency in a decision to release records, including video, of the 2016 shooting by a white police officer of Jeremiah Mitchell, a Black Cedar Rapids man paralyzed by the shots. In Polk County, a district court judge in October ordered Parizik to pay a $100 civil penalty and the department to pay the legal cost of a civil rights advocate who sued Parizik for not releasing body camera video from officers involved in a contentious 2018 arrest. The public has an interest in how police respond to calls of service, Judge Paul Scott ruled on October 6. Police departments are funded by the public and answer to the public. O'Brien, the Cedar Rapids lawyer, thinks the fine should be higher, maybe $100 a day, or officers should face possible simple misdemeanor charges for not releasing video. Lee Rood writes, from Lee Rood's Reader's Watchdog, their team was demoted, and fans denied refunds. When the COVID-19 pandemic came out of left field, all of the heavy hitters in baseball called their lawyers. Minor league players moved forward with a class-action lawsuit contending that they had been paid less than minimum wage for years. Minor league clubs who lost a whole season sued their insurance providers. Major League Baseball and all 30 of its teams, which lost billions of dollars with an abbreviated fan-free season, did the same. Loyal fans such as Wayne Tolander lost out too, but so far, he says, no one seems to care. Before the coronavirus emptied stadiums around the country, Tolander spent $630 on season tickets for two box seats, row 4, behind home plate, heading into the Burlington Bees 2020 minor league season at Community Field. In June, the pandemic forced Minor League Baseball to cancel the 2020 season for the first time in its 119-year history. Then, in December, came an even worse blow. Major League Baseball announced a complete minor league restructuring, downsizing from 162 clubs across the country to 120. The move allowed it to announce better pay for the minor league players who remain, but it resulted in the Bees, the Clinton Lumber Kings, and 40 other teams losing their major league affiliations in the 2021 season. This month, the Bees announced they were going to join the Prospect League, a collegiate woodbat league that will play a much shorter 2.5-month summer season. The players, mostly from Midwest colleges, won't have the same cachet as minor league baseball players, who stood a chance of eventually working their way up from a single A B's to the team's Major League Baseball affiliate, the Los Angeles Angels. Now, it's a totally different situation than when I first bought the tickets, said Tolander, who contacted Watchdog after nearly a year of trying to get a refund. I think I deserve my money back. But Kim Parker, general manager of the Burlington Baseball Association, said all Bees tickets clearly state on the back that there will be no cash refunds. She said the Bees board decided to offer ticket exchanges after the pandemic hit. In mid-September, season ticket holders were told that they could opt to donate what they had paid for their tickets to the Burlington Baseball Association or have their season tickets rolled over to the 2021 season. Tolander said the Bees treated him differently after the season shut down than the Iowa Cubs, for whom he also held 2020 season tickets. The AAA Des Moines team returned his ticket money right after he called, he said, unlike the Bees, who refused to when he called over the spring, fall, and winter. Michael Gartner, co-owner of the Iowa Cubs, said he knows of no refund policy announced for all the teams in minor league baseball. We offered refunds to anyone who wanted one, but most season ticket holders opted just to credit the money toward season tickets for this year's season. I don't recall how many people asked for their money back, but it wasn't a big number. There was another difference, however. The Iowa Cubs kept their affiliation with the Chicago Cubs in last month's shakeup. Parker, defending the Bees' refusal to provide refunds, said it's not fair or correct at this point to assume the Bees' 2021 season ticket package for the Prospect League team has less value than the 2020 package for the minor league team. The value of the 2021 season ticket package is yet undetermined, as we have only been a part of the Prospect League for less than 2 weeks, and a schedule for that league is not yet finalized, she wrote in a statement. There is also the opportunity that season ticket holders will have access to other athletic events held at Community Field. Every effort will be made to be fair and equitable to our season ticket holders. We are just still working through that process. Of course, 2020 was lousy for all minor league teams who rely on revenue from ticket sales, concessions, and sponsorships to survive. Those teams carry insurance like Major League Baseball teams, but coverage for business losses hinges on the policy language. Ben Bellis, an attorney for the Iowa Attorney General's office, said scores of consumers lost big after the pandemic shut down businesses, scuttling planned weddings and travel, and forcing the cancellations of other ticketed events. Many of the disputes taking place come down to civil contract law, and most contracts provide businesses an out clause for something called impossibility and impracticability of performance. Essentially, that means it would be unfair to force a business to abide by a contractual agreement if it is made impossible or impractical by unforeseeable events. Every state recognizes some form of the law of impossibility, either in common law or by code. For that reason, Bella said, it's more difficult for investigators at the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division, whose primary focus is consumer fraud, to seek resolution to losses tied to the pandemic. Of course, all kinds of variables come into play, but in this case, neither party created the COVID crisis, and the baseball team certainly didn't lobby to get reduced in their stature, he said. It'd be a different story if the Bees had known for sure they were going to get knocked out of the minor league and then sold season tickets to people like Tolander, Bellis said. As Watchdog wrote last April, some fans last year accused the Chicago Cubs, the iCubs' major league affiliate, of failing to refund customers. In the example the column mentioned, the man in question eventually did get a refund. Refunding Tolander and others like him, who handed over a lot of money for nothing, would be the right thing to do if he has no interest in Prospect League games. But in baseball's ongoing pandemic calamity, only the lawyers are sure to get paid. William Morris writes, Court upholds dismissal of 2015 Cedar Rapids police shooting suit. A federal appellate court has upheld a decision dismissing a lawsuit from the family of a man killed by Cedar Rapids police. Jonathan Gossman, age 21, was shot 24 times and died after police said he pulled a handgun while fleeing from an October 2015 traffic stop investigating the manufacture of methamphetamine. His wife and mother sued multiple Cedar Rapids officers in 2018, claiming excessive force, false arrest, and other claims. A federal court dismissed the case in April 2019, finding the officers' actions were justified. On appeal, the three-judge panel upheld that decision. In their opinion, issued on December 23rd, they said the two officers who shot Gossman did not violate his Fourth Amendment rights. One of the officers involved told interviewers after the shooting he thought he saw and heard a shot from Gossman before returning fire. Gossman's gun, although loaded, had not been fired, which his family pointed to in making their excessive force argument. The court said, whether Gossman shot at officers did not change whether the officers were justified in shooting him. Deadly force was authorized because Gossman pulled a gun, and thus the officers were faced with an apparent loaded weapon, the court wrote, citing rulings on previous police shootings. Gossman's family also challenged the initial traffic stop, which began after officers on a stakeout saw multiple people buying a medication used to create meth and get into the same truck. Although buying the medication itself is not illegal, the court said, officers recognized several of the occupants from previous meth cases and observed a flurry of movement happening inside the truck, enough to support reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. Charles City Attorney Judith O'Donohue, who represented Gossman's family, declined to comment. Andrew May Sahari writes, Longtime Polk County Treasurer Maloney dies. Longtime Polk County Treasurer Mary Maloney has died unexpectedly, the Polk County Board of Supervisors announced in a Friday evening news release. Maloney had held the office for 7 terms, since January of 1989, or for more than 3 decades before her death. The Polk County Board of Supervisors has not discussed the circumstances of her death. Mary Maloney was a public servant through and through. She had a passion for her job each and every day and was committed to the office of Polk County Treasurer and the residents of Polk County. Polk County Board of Supervisors Chair Angela Connolly said in the news release, We are all shocked and deeply saddened. This is a profound loss to our community. Maloney is survived by a husband and 4 children, according to the release. Her family would like privacy at this time, the board indicated in the release. This is awful. Mary was a joy to be around, was in politics for the right reasons, and really cared. Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand tweeted Friday, A Decor native to boot, rest in peace. Our thoughts go out to her loved ones. Former chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, Troy Price, said in a tweet Saturday, It is impossible to imagine Iowa Democratic politics without Mary Maloney. Teresa Greenfield, former Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, called Maloney a true public servant. Sarah K. LeBlanc writes, Dallas County Recorder will not seek another term. Dallas County Recorder Chad Earhart announced to a news release Friday that he will not seek a 4th term. Earhart, a Republican, was first elected in 2010 and ran unopposed in 2014 and in 2018. During his tenure, Earhart has contributed in digitizing all records dating back to 1850 in the recorder's office, as well as military and other records such as birth, death, and marriage certificates. He has served on the Iowa Recorders Association Executive Board as chairman of the Iowa Republican County Officials Association, and in 2014 received the Property Records Industry Association's Carl Ernst Scholarship, which is given to 1 county elected official nationwide each year, the release states. Earhart said in the release, It has been an honor to serve Dallas County. I'm proud of how we have run the recorder's office and what we've been able to accomplish, she said. I will forever be grateful to the citizens of Dallas County for the opportunity. My colleagues that I have shared elected office with within Dallas County and throughout a great state, and my staff that has worked so hard to accomplish all we have. After 12 years, Earhart said in the release he feels there is nothing more for me to accomplish here. He did not rule out running for political office in the future. I'm only 43 years of age. I'm hopeful that there is a lot of life left out there for me to do many other things, he said, and I look forward to focusing on my family, business, and whatever opportunities present themselves in the future. And we'll wrap up this first hour of the Register with the latest COVID-19 statistics for the state of Iowa. Confirmed cases are 318,446, an increase of 1,065. There have been 4,651 deaths, an increase of 74, since 10 a.m. Saturday. Hospitalizations are at 376, down from 383. Patients in the ICU are 84, up from 82. And patients on ventilators are 31, up from 29. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thank you for listening.